Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's Jimmy Carboni. It's May 21st, 2013. It's Mead and the first annual New York City Mead Week. And we got some great guests tonight. We're here on the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. Thanks so much. And the Good Beer Seal and Association of 41 New York City Beer Bars. All right, here we are on Beer Sessions Radio. My buddy Michael Fairbrother from Moonlight Meadery and his wife. Tell us your name.
Bernice Vanderburn.
And you're here, and we got our buddy Raphael Lyon, who's a kind of a new small winemaker of ciders and some meads and things and everything. So it's an interesting group here, waiting for Chris Kuzume, who's the Fermentabar host, who's also a big part of mead. And today is the special day at the New York City Homebrewers Guild. It's their annual mead meeting.
Right.
So Michael came down just for that, and after that we're going to go to Burp Castle. And we're going to taste a bunch of meads and homebrew meads, too. So, Michael, you've been doing this a long time, and I've met you a couple times. How did you first start making mead? Because you have a great story.
Yeah, back in 1995, I had just started homebrewing beer in May. And by July, I was at the Boston Wort Processors and the Brew for Your Die annual picnic, and somebody offered me a sizer. I had no idea what it was, but I didn't want to embarrass myself, so I said, sure, I'd try it. Now, you ever seen a baby make that little face when it tries something it loves for the first time? That's what happened. I was 29 years
old.
Show
me that face.
Yeah, it just pops right up. And I went home and started making it. And by 2006, I was starting to win some pretty good competitions. But I had an epiphany. I realized when I pulled out a bottle of beer that I was making, every guy in the room was hanging out with me. But when I pulled out a bottle of mead, every woman in the room was knocking somebody over. I said, there has to be a business opportunity for this. Last year, we ended up selling over 5,000 cases. Last Friday, we sold over 1,000 cases in one day.
Wow. So are you still like a small business, or are you like this giant in the world of mead?
We're getting to be a giant, I think. We've got 1,000-gallon fermenters at this point, so you can make 10,000 bottles per batch. We have two of those. We're now looking to expand to a 15,000-square-foot facility. We've got 4 full-time employees in production and 3 full-time people in sales.
All right. And Raphael, you're here as a – I know you're a licensed New York State – what, winery?
Farm winery.
Farm winery.
Right.
And I've had your ciders before, which I've liked a lot. Do you also make a mead?
Pretty much everything I make is actually technically a mead. If you put honey in it, it's a mead. So probably what you had was an apple wine, an apple honey wine, I guess is how it would be called technically.
And then how did you get started? Because you know, you had a farm upstate, and the next thing you know, you were trying to sell meat to me and cider.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think if you look at the history of New York State and what it produces kind of in its own sort of special way, a lot of that is apples and honey. And we have some really great beekeepers in New York and really great apple farmers. So when I started making alcohol, I was looking to those kind of local resources. Instead of trying to import another way of making wine or alcohol, I sort of look at what we had and started there. And so the first things I was making were these sparkling apple wines. And I think you were actually the first person to carry it.
I was, and I was really proud of it. You had a carboy, and we put it on the bar, the little siphon system.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty neat. And, okay, so let's talk about mead. So we're going to the homebrew, New York City Homebrew Guild tonight. We're going to taste some meads. I'm back. I think when I was in college, the first beer that guys knew that I knew made was like a mead. And how do you make a basic mead?
So you start with honey. We never pasteurize our honey, so we only warm it up to about 80 degrees so we can lower the viscosity. We blend in cold water, add yeast, control the fermentation temperature for about 3 months. We get about 15-16% alcohol. Then we rack it into secondary, where we let it age and drop to clarity, and filter and bottle.
All right. So, Bernice, tell us, you guys are up in Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Correct.
My cousins live there, the Ebba family, and I've actually haven't been there in like 20 or 30 years, so I'm due to visit. But what's your facility like? I know you make it there. Can people go and taste there as well?
Everything gets made right on site. We are right off exit 4 of Highway 93 North. So definitely come over and visit. We're open 7 days a week for tours and tastings. And we are currently in a 4,000-square-foot facility. So we have grown from our double garage, literally 400 square feet. We moved into a 2,000-square-foot facility, and we are busting at the seams currently.
So what about New Hampshire laws? Have they helped you grow and develop? Is that a good place to make wine and mead?
It's turned out to be that way, but we had to get a law changed. So you couldn't make wine that was above 15.5% alcohol unless it was fortified and unless it had grapes in it. Since we don't use any grapes in our products, that was a challenge for us. And our bestseller, Kurt's Apple Pie and Desire, are both pushing almost 17% alcohol. So the state of New Hampshire Liquor Control Board said, you can't make this anymore. And I happened to have some good friends, and I contacted one of the kids I went to kindergarten with. Well, he's no longer a kid. He's an old man like me now. And his father happens to be the in the House of Representatives, and helped and worked with us to help get the law changed to allow us to make these meads. And we got that law passed last year, signed by the governor. And it's now easy for us to continue doing great business.
So you tasted us on this first one. It's got like a pink color.
Yep. This is it's called Wild. It's a dry blueberry. It goes really well with like grilled steak tips. The char from the grill really kind of pulls out the honey notes. Has a nice alcohol, a little lightness to it, but it's almost 14%. So, you know, for the alcohol level, it's really quite tasty and light.
Yeah. Let's taste us on another one, too.
Sure thing.
What's your apple pie? Tell us about that one. Yeah. Kurt's apple pie.
Kurt's apple pie. So this one's made with 25% honey, 75% apple cider. Then we add Vietnamese cinnamon and Madagascar bourbon, vanilla beans, and secondary. So it really has that apple pie like
flavor. So the mead has like, it's kind of a general term, because we met a guy a couple weeks ago from Denmark who's making mead, and he's mostly using honey, but you also put in fruit juice. Right? Whoa, disaster.
Crash.
Crazy. This is the quietest show we've ever had. The meat guys aren't that talkative. I mean,
so, other than dropping my own meat on the floor, which is a sin. You can make melomels, which are meads made with fruit, or methaglens, meads made with spices. All our meads have at least 51% base fermentables from honey.
So when you go to the Homebrew Guild tonight in Burb Castle, give us a little snippet of the presentation you'll be making, because I know how that works.
I'm going to talk to him about how we started, how we've grown, pretty much, you know, from 2007, when I actually formed the company, I was thinking I was going to do this part-time at night. And that year, I won my first Mead Maker of the Year award at the New England Regional Homebrew Competition. Had no time for the business. So 2008, again, I paid the state of New Hampshire the $100 to kind of keep the company afloat. That year, I won my second straight Mead Maker of the Year award. And in 2009, I was literally between me and $100 throwing the company away. And I was at the Craft Brewers Conference in Boston, and I was talking to Omar from Surly Brewing Company. And when I told him how I was going to do this part-time at night, he changed my life with one sentence. He looked at me and he said, "How can you possibly think you can do something you love part-time?" And that changed everything. Between then and September, I worked on my business plan. This competition was coming around again. Won my third straight Mead Maker of the Year award. And better still, I won Best of Show. First place out of 353 entries, and I literally drove home from this competition bawling my eyes out, because I was in control of my life up until that point. I was a chief executive in a software company, and here I am throwing all that away to kind of chase my dreams. And the last 3 years have been nothing but incredible.
That's a great story. Bernice, you've been part of that, right?
I have. I am a mead lover. Michael and I actually met. I was actively seeking some decent cider to drink. I come from South Africa. Couldn't find anything comparable to a cider that I used to drink back home. And Michael used to have a blog online. And I thought to myself, well, as president of Brew Free or Die at that point, if he couldn't find me a cider that I liked, I was out of luck. And I fell in love with mead, and I went ahead and married me a mead maker.
Wow, that's romantic. So you're right. So you did get the ladies by making mead instead of beer.
Yeah, it's what I didn't realize as a young man is when you make a woman happy, they tell every single friend they have. My word-of-mouth advertising has been off the charts. You know, we grew last year by 76% from the year before that. The year before that was 760%.
Don't scare him with numbers,
man. Yeah, it was just massive.
Anecdotes, please.
They're good.
I do like anecdotes. Like Bernie said, this is here from South Africa, so you actually do like mead, you like cider. And we've met a lot of people from England who appreciate different styles of cider. Like, there's some Spanish ciders that are really funky, you know. Super tart, you know, barnyard nosy, and usually the English people like that. What do you think is different about the palates in America?
I think with us, what we've managed to succeed in is we've taken an old product, basically the ancestor of fermented beverages, and we've refined it. And our target market mainly is women. So our marketing, our tagline, Romance by the Glass, the fact that the story goes that it's tied in from where the term honeymoon comes from. All of our wines have romantic names. We keep the guys happy. We have our Jaded series. We have Scorn and Fury, and we have fun with the names. But I think we've really refined it, and we've been successful because we've taken it to the mainstream market. We don't just sell it or market it to sort of the Renaissance Fair target market audience. We've mainstreamed it.
And what was the name of the beer? The mead you just poured from
the mic. Yep, that one's Sensual. That one's
Sensual. Wow.
A traditional mead.
I didn't know I was getting into this. This is fun.
So we started our product line with Desire, which is our flagship. That's the one that won the Best of Show. And my original tagline for the company was Curl Your Toes with Mead. You know, I was trying to be suggestively cute and kind of the innuendo about it. My buddy came over and he said, yeah, but toe curling can be bad. I'm like, shit, hadn't thought of that. And so we changed the tagline to Romance by the Glass, and all the mead names kind of fit into that story.
All right. Well, going back, when you won your Mead Maker of the Year awards, I mean, what was it about your mead that won? I mean, there must be some qualities that you identified that would win a competition.
Yeah, I think it's got to do with not being afraid to go big. So being big in 15, 16, 17% alcohols versus 10, 11, 12% alcohol. Really going first with flavors that I like. I'll never make a mead that I don't want to drink. And every single mead that we make, I make over 66 varieties now, I make for myself. If nobody's going to drink them, perfect. I get to drink what I like. And that's where I want to come from, which is, you know, do what I love and love what I do.
All right, let's raise our glasses and make a toast.
Cheers.
And Raphael, what do you think about these meads?
I'm into them. They're good. I'm going to try all of them.
It's hard for me to judge them. I mean, it's, you know, because they're a little sweeter than what I'm used to drinking. I've had your meads before and I like them, but it's definitely a different product.
Yeah, it's a whole new category, and that's what we're trying to do, which is I'm not trying to emulate anybody else. That's why I make 66 varieties. I'm trying to define the whole category of what mead can be, whether it's very bone dry, really tart. We have some barrel aged ones. We make some in Sam Adams Utopias barrels. We get over $100 a bottle for a 375 milliliter bottle, and I can't keep it in stock.
Wow, that's amazing.
I think that's probably the most interesting thing about mead is nobody really knows what it's supposed to taste like. When people were making mead, you know, it was 5,000 years ago. So actually, unlike making red wine, which has all these sort of expectations of like, okay, so it's a, you know, Bordeaux, and it has to be a certain way. It's a version of a Bordeaux. It's a dark Bordeaux. It's a heavy one. It's a light one. With mead, it's, you know, you can really start from scratch because it's typically something that, I mean, my guess is that most of the meads you make are not just honey and water. They always have some other aspect that's like works with it, right?
We actually make several. The one you just tried was just honey and water. Mm-hmm. We have another one made with tupelo blossom honey. We make some with orange blossom honey. We have, we've made, 1 year alone, I made over 60 different single source varietal honey meads just to play, see what each flavor of that honey can contribute.
And nice. It makes a difference depending on the honey that you use, your end product. And unlike wine, we don't, you'll never find a vintage on our bottles because simply every season your honey can change. Your seasonal fruits are going to change. You could have a beehive in the same orchard. And if you harvest that honey early fall versus late summer, the honey's going to be different.
All right. Let's raise our glasses. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
You're listening to Never in Love by Four Lincolns on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
So, you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, GreatBrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. GreatBrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, GreatBrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile Beer Cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit GreatBrewers.com today.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guess what? It's May, and you should join Heritage Radio Network. I'm a member. I'm number 501. I'm very proud to have my membership card in my wallet, and you get a lot of special benefits. And check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. Michael, are you going to be a member of Heritage Radio Network?
Think so. Why not?
Yeah, Moonlight Meadery. Come on.
Yeah, you'll get two for one.
We're expanding. We got Justin Kennedy. We got Eddie. We got these great guys in the studio tonight, and Chris Kuzmer just walked in, who is now he was president of New York City Homebrewers Guild, and he's the reason why we're doing a mead show tonight, because this is the annual Homebrewers Mead Night, isn't it?
Yes, this is the 13th annual mead meeting of the New York City Homebrewers Guild,
and I think it's one of the first ones I ever sat in on a few years ago, where it was like meads of all types and shapes and colors and
it's mind blowing to me. I mean, I was unfamiliar with mead until this meeting, and it just blew my mind. I love the diversity, and it's a delicious beverage.
What's like one of the weirdest meads you ever had?
Durian mead. My friend made durian mead, and so if you're not familiar with the fruit durian is a very, if you look it up on Wikipedia, it actually
durian
has
the
distinct smell of pig shit. And so my friend entered this into a lot of competitions, homebrew competitions. And it definitely had that smell. I mean, it's one of those fruits that's like really sweet to the taste, but has a really horrible aroma. And if you enter into a special category in a homebrew competition, you have to send a description of what that unfamiliar kind of thing is. If it's that weird an ingredient, you have to do that. And so he got all these judge sheets back that all said, yes, it has the distinct aroma of pig shit.
You said pig shit.
Yes. So, I mean, it was aptly, you know, they had to score
you're
it right.
You're defining barnyard smell, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was, I do. That's one thing I love funky, about man. These type of products is Raphael Lyons here. Lion. I always call him Lyons. I met you a long time ago, our good friend Sarah Grady at Glenwood introduced us, and you started making your own. You're calling it honey mead or apple mead. You're kind of like crossing over categories, because I always thought you were a cider maker.
Yeah, The feds kind of hate me, because every time I send something in, they're just like, this isn't... It's always sort of in between. But, I mean, from the government's point of view, if you put honey in it, it's mead. You can put a drop of honey in it, and if it's a juice and you're making wine, it's mead. So,
well, only if it's under 14% alcohol.
Right, true. Yeah, exactly. So, or above 6, right? I mean, if I was starting to make cider, it'd be a little...
So what's under 6%?
I mean, as far as I understand it, it's like if you're making basically a wine strength alcohol, let's say around 12%.
So between 6 and 14%?
Yeah, they're under 17. Then you are making wine if you're not using, grains. And so at that point, they say, what kind of wine are you making? If you use honey at all, it's a honey wine. And then you add, you know, it's a honey apple wine, it's a honey black currant wine, it's a honey with an infusion. And those are all, I mean, if you use the kind of more ancient terms like you do on your labels, like I can never pronounce them, so I sort of skip it.
Melomel.
Right. So there's also a kind of traditional way to think about mead that involves like, well, are you using a juice? Like this one that we just had with the black cherry.
Blueberry and black currant.
Yeah, so like, you know, there's a traditional mead that's called a black mead that has black currant in it. But it's not a... legal term, you know.
Then what happens when you go over 14%? This is what I understand. So in New Hampshire, you have these different rules, but yeah. You're 14% or 17%.
You hit different registry rules for the TTB. So category 24 is for traditional meads. Like, you can make a mead with up to 1 pound of hops per 100 gallons of product. Well, anybody that's a homebrewer would laugh at those numbers. 1 pound of hops for 100 gallons a batch of beer, you're not going to taste them.
Yeah.
So anything that we make, for the most part, which is above 14%, they won't let us put the term mead on the label. That's why our company is named Moonlight Meadery, because they make you put on the label other than standard or specialty wine, which means it's higher in alcohol, and then you have to list out the components of the product, like 22% honey, 72% cider, or whatever the case may be. But they want you to imagine that you're not using any water. So the honey has got the same sugar content as like apple cider. Well, honey's thick. You know, honey's what, 65 bricks? So the content of the sugar matters, because that's what ferments and makes alcohol. So it shouldn't be the percentage of the component. It's rather the percentage of the base fermentables from that component that should matter.
But basically, I think you'd probably agree that like the entire structure of the TTB and all the laws from the state down are built around grape wine.
Absolutely.
And so when you make mead, you're just always running into this sort of issue around labeling or the contents, which is just like you know, honestly, like there should – I'm not allowed to put a like a vintage date. We talked about this, right? Why? Because I make wine, not a honey, not for any other reason. You know, if you made it out of grapes, you can have a vintage date, but you just can't. They just don't let you do it. So, the least interesting and least fun part of this is dealing with the government.
But your license is a New York State farm winery license,
right? So I have a farm winery license, which is kind of interesting because I'm probably at a similar place where you started, in the sense that I'm operating out of 400 square feet, but my business model really works with the state law, which allows, as a farm winery, I'm allowed to sell directly to customers, and I'm also allowed to wholesale. I can basically sell at any point that...
And that's how we started as well.
Right. And that's really exciting for me because I come from a kind of political background that is really interested in the CSA model of being a farmer. And the CSA model means that you're not producing necessarily to distribute for a kind of random group of people, but rather you have a very specific relationship with a very small amount of people, and you make wine for them. So 90% of my wine is pre-sold. I have a subscription of people who were sort of invested in what I do, and they buy a certain amount of wine every year, and they don't get to pick it.
Let's taste some of yours, because I haven't had yours in a couple years, Raphael. Okay. Let me ask you this. So when you have your CSA model, mm-hmm. do people get to taste your product before they buy it?
No.
So this is more like just a trust thing.
It's a trust thing.
It's cool, but do they really like your product?
They come back, and I'm always sold out. I mean, actually, the most exciting thing that's happening right now is I'm expanding, so I'm opening up. I'll get like 30 new spots in the CSA. So this is a bottle that was in the winter CSA, and it's a wild fermented apple honey wine.
It's a nice looking bottle. You have this kind of cork cap thing,
right?
Do you buy these, or do you have someone make this for you? Do you bottle it yourself? How do you do this? This is like amazing.
I do.
I mean, there's a barn in the Hudson Valley where you're used to have carboys, fermenting.
Yeah, I mean
you've
know,
really
there's
gone a long way here.
There's nothing that I'm doing that. Let's let that one breathe, actually, if you can. There's nothing I'm doing that a homebrewer couldn't do. I mean, the equipment's really small. I'm stepping up the size of the fermenters, but I do all the labels pretty much myself, or I have some artist friends. This is a artist friend, Kevin Hoyman, who did that Saturnalia label. So this is a buckwheat-infused dry honey wine made out of wildflower honey. So we can start with that. This would have been in the...
That was the smallest pour ever on the air, Raphael. He gave me like... Forget the two fingers. Come on. I got at least two fingers
on
the air.
You got the two
sips.
Come on, I only got like two cases of this left, you know.
But you already opened the bottle. What, are you going to recork it and save it for later?
Yeah, right. Right? So this I really like a lot. And the interesting thing about buckwheat is that it's not a grain. Technically, it's a fruit, so you're allowed to use it.
Wow.
Which is exciting. I work with a lot of tea people. Part of the history of mead making is like a really long tradition of infusing herbs, medicinal herbs, magical herbs. And if you had looked at what people were making mead with a long time ago, it'd be pretty weird. You know, they'd put all kinds of stuff in there. One of the research projects that we're doing, and if you go on enlightenmentwines.com, we have a blog, and I've been doing a research project around a an ancient mead that the Picts made in Scotland, or what was before Scotland, which was probably psychotropic and had an enormous amount of protein in it. And they found evidence of this, and we were sort of researching this kind of wine. And they were using heather tips, which are, you know, it's basically like grass. You know, it's like some kind of weed that grows out there. Would have tasted really woody. I'm super interested in knowing what that might taste like.
So you mean like psychotropes, like what? They had wild mushrooms or something?
There was probably a fungus that grew on the heather tips that were infused in the wine. I mean, there's, you know, obviously I can't make that and sell it, but the you know, it existed. You know, this wine with the apple, which we'll try next, has a lemon verbena infusion in it, which is, you know, really nice flavor. It's really important to me. And then the dandelion wine is something that I started making actually for this shop in Greenpoint, because, you know, it's called dandelion wine, and they had never found a dandelion wine that they liked to drink. And people would, you know, you Google dandelion wine, you get the shop in Greenpoint. And, you know, that's something that I spent 3 years making. But because of this way that my place works, because everything's so small, I can run like 10 variations at once and do that in over 3 years to get the yeast and figure out all the different ratios of the flowers. And then I work with wildcrafters upstate who, you know, they walk around on their hands and pick flowers for like a week. And they freeze them, and then I go pick them up.
Cheers, man. You've really, cheers. This is amazing stuff. Cheers. So, like, and Chris, I mean, as a home brewer and a brewer.
We can have more of this, actually.
Thank you. I'm sorry. We're loosening
it's,
you up.
It's only 12%. It's like I don't make them quite as strong as Moonlight does, but so they're a little.
No, we got both. We've got this total artiste, and we've got this really great, successful, award-winning, you know, producer here. This is pretty awesome.
But what's great about it is it's that the craft palate today is so, it's grown and it's evolved. And people are not happy with the same old anymore. They really are interested in choice.
And if you think about the explosiveness of the market, I mean, I started my garage, the hope of making 400 gallons per year. My smallest fermenter at this point is 500 gallons. You know, I'm just trying to keep up with everybody that's calling me and asking for product at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the interesting things about the whole field is that we're now at a place, I mean, this radio network is part of it. I'm really excited to be here. But there's something really kind of profound happening in food in the last maybe 5 years, especially in New York, especially in Brooklyn, which is that the level of conversation around food and around drinking has changed. And it's not so much about being good. It's not so much about a good version of something. It's a lot more about being interesting. And what are the potentials? Like, what can we do with a pizza? Like, what's the possibilities of it? And that's a conversation that starts to border on the kind of discourse that you might have around other fields, like philosophy or art. So, you know, it's things that we have, like, a kind of really long tradition. And so I think one of the nice things about working in mead, because it's sort of undefined, you can propose questions through it about what is, like you said, like what can this be? You do 66 varieties. Like, imagine a winemaker making 66 varieties of grape wine. Like, it's a completely different kind of mentality.
And the flavor profile pairs up with food so much better than grape wine can. I mean, think of how many chefs work honey into the cheese plates or roast dishes or pick the flavor. Honey just accentuates that natural taste of the food.
Sure does. Chris Kuzma, I want to ask a quick question. Okay. So I'm a college student just out of college. I want to make my quick and easy first brew ever, and it's going to be a mead, and I'm going to take Grolsch bottles and cap them and pour them.
No problem. That's great.
What, give me a quick recipe.
Well, I'm a big fan of short meads, and if it's your first recipe and you're going, what is a short mead? Short meads are meads that are actually, they're sparkling, they're about 5%, they're low in alcohol, they can be beautiful, and they can be done in a week or 2 weeks kind of thing. You want to drink them fresh, you don't want to give them too much time, and you can have them carbonate right there in your little Grolsch bottle. And actually, I have several that we'll share with you today that Mary and I just made last week, and I have one that I'm making at 508, and part of the reason why I'm making it at 508 is because, according to DTB, I'm not allowed to make anything strong if it's a wine. So I'm allowed to make a mead that's 6.99% or lower.
And it's technically a beer or something?
Well, I have to put a little bit of honey malt in there.
You have to wave a barley leaf over it or something.
Yeah, I have to sprinkle some barley in there, and I'm allowed to do it.
The whiff of barley.
But how do you do that? How do you make one of these? 2 pounds, get a 1 gallon jug of distilled water from from your local store. Get a one plastic jug. You can do everything right in this jug. And then get 2 gallons, or sorry, 2 pounds of honey. And first of all, take about 4 cups out of that jug. Heat that up, blend it with your honey so that your honey is viscous. Pour all of that right back into the jug. Shake it up to aerate it, and then throw just some champagne yeast in it, and just let it ferment for a week. But make sure that you have the lid a little bit open so it doesn't explode on you. And best thing to do is to sanitize it if you have any sanitizer. But this will yield.
So I'm coming to Burp Castle tonight. I'm going to check it out. I'm going to try all the different meads that you guys made. And is there a site? Imagine I was just out of college, just turned 21, and I wanted to make a fast mead. Is there a good site with the recipe?
There's a great site. Actually, so we'll have more links to stuff at nycmeadweek.com. I've just started that. but my girlfriend Mary has actually a bunch of short mead recipes on her blog called mylifeoncraft.com.
All right. And it's so great. Chris, you're on. Chris and Mary are the hosts of Ferment About It, which is a show here on Heritage Radio Network on Mondays. And don't forget, you can be a member too. So, all right, guess what? It's first we'll make a toast again.
Oh, should we
we're into like our 14th mead right now.
All right.
And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
You're listening to Southern Pretender by the Four Lincolns on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Keep it locked for more beer sessions, everybody.
Wake up the children, clear the halls. This is something I've been through before.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Breathe Southern Pretender, sister, mother, hide your children, hide your jewelry under the pillow. Sleep on it, a man in the white shoe.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Roberta's in Brooklyn. We've got this pizza that Raphael ordered. It's sitting here, and what's better? Raphael, it's your first time out here. You're kind of impressed, aren't you?
I remember you talking about this as an idea about 3 years ago, and I was like, and I was just, okay, you're going to have like some closet. It's going to be kind of moldy, and then maybe you'll have like a computer, what do you think about a web radio? And this is nice. I mean, you've got a huge window. We can look at all the people eating, and you've got all this cool equipment.
Network rocks, man. This is cool.
This is the nicest inside of a shipping container I've ever seen.
Yeah. And we got to eat at Roberta's. Usually a typical night here at Beer Sessions Radio, we're hanging out with our guests, drinking their product. Then we'll have dinner at Roberta's, and maybe it's a, I don't know. What do we usually eat when we come out here? Besides pizza, there's a lot more than that. So maybe pork collar from Mangalese to pork collar. All these beer and food pairings. There's all this potential.
Steak is bangarang.
Yeah, we don't have steak tips in New York, buddy Michael over there.
Well, we have a mead that can go with the pizza. We have a mead, a couple of meads that'll go with pizza. So you're good.
You might have,
have you ever made a pizza mead? There's that, there's a pizza beer out there. And
not going to happen.
Do you know why my head is so hammered tonight? We're going to do a quick recap. They had that Googa Mooga event this weekend, but we had a better event. We had Taste of Tribeca, which was the 19th year of it, 70 restaurants, all for local schools downtown. That was my Saturday, and I had a lot of fun. We have do so many great food events, and looking forward to a lot more. We have Jazz Age Lawn Party this year. It's a big event on Governor's Island. We're going to produce some of the food portion of that. And we're going to go up the Hudson Valley this year. And last week, I think I spent like 2 whole days with the Newburgh Brewing guys.
Oh, yeah.
And they have if you want to go up the Hudson Valley on the Memorial Day weekend or any day this summer, go to Newburgh Brewing. It's probably the nicest brewery in the whole New York State. It's an awesome tasting room. And I really had a great time up there. You have views of the Hudson. I think the Hudson Valley is really coming up. We're talking about products like cider and mead. But there's more and more breweries. Peekskill is now, everyone, I think, acknowledges them as the best new small brewery in New York. And you got Newburgh Brewing, and you got Keegan's in Kingston. And it's like you could work your way up the Hudson. So I recommend that. So, all right, guys.
Cheers.
Join
cheers.
In with me. Come on. I'm just wiped out. I'm wiped out. There's too many events this weekend. Everybody's getting crazy.
So, Jimmy, I have a theory of how mead came about. There's a cave painting that dates back 20,000 years ago. It shows man harvesting honey from beehives. Okay? Honey's been around for a long time. So let's say 20,000 years ago, somebody got clever enough to paint a painting of this. Now, as a previous beekeeper, I can tell you can't take honey from a beehive and expect the bees not to come after you. So they had to figure out how they were going to store this honey. They could do it in a deep, dark cave like they're finding honey these days that's 6,000 years old in Bulgaria and Russia. Or you could put honey underneath water, because honey's the only food source that never goes bad. Honey's the only food source man can survive on, just water. And you know what? You can reach down through that water, grab that honey, eat it, drink the water as you're hunting and gathering. And as honey sits underwater, it starts to dissolve, and it starts to naturally ferment into alcohol. And the rest is history.
That's a beautiful story. So what about the stories about, like, bears, like, reaching into some... Okay, the same kind of thing. So there's, like, a tree trunk. There's like, a honey hive, and it got filled with water. And the same thing. So you're saying that's how it ferments naturally?
Yeah,
and then puts his paw in and gets some fermented honey.
That story is probably more convoluted than the natural instinct of just taking honey from a beehive. And, you know, the first story I ever heard was, okay, these elephants crashed into these trees in Africa, and magically it rained, and this turned into honey wine. Well, okay, elephants crashing into tree trunks, and it raining, and the bees not being able to get the honey in time, versus man being clever enough to figure out, hey, by the way, nothing pathogenic will live in a fermented beverage. I can walk around with a food source I need to live on, and I got water to get by. And if I find an antelope or a deer or whatnot that I can kill to eat, bonus. You know, I can put a little honey on top of that, and after I fry it up, it's good.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of nutrition in this, like, whole story. I mean, I think in America, and contemporary alcohol drinkers, like, they drink it because it, like, accompanies food, or maybe they get drunk. But there's a lot of reasons to drink fermented beverages, and historically, you know, like, substance is one of them. You know, this one of the things we learned when we studied the Picts was that, like, when you think about the Picts, you have to think about these, like, dwarfish, like, massive, short, stocky men covered in tattoos who fought off every single invader for 2,000 years, including the Roman army. This is like where the dwarves come from. Tolkien's dwarves are based on these people, and it's because they were drinking this honey wine, because it was, you know, that honey was so hard to get out that when they fermented, they just fermented in the hive with all the bees and everything. And they'd eat all that. That would all go in there. And then it just got, you know, fierce.
Chris, I feel like you must have a quote. What's the Benjamin Franklin quote?
Which
something. Drinking is good for you. That's all I can tell you.
Fear not for the meat is good for you.
My quote that I usually say is inebriation is not a destination point. It's a perk for those with good taste.
All right.
That's my cheers.
And I'm more interested in what Bernice says, because I feel like South Africa still has this, like, first of all, you have a great accent.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I've been here for 13 years. I haven't lost my accent yet, but people tell me not to, so I won't. When you look at, listen to Michael's story, I've got to say, coming from Africa, when you look at the history of mead, yes, a lot of the historical references do go back to Africa, probably way before Africa was actually even its own continent. So, we tell the story of about how Neolithic paintings show honey gatherers. And if you think about how the story goes, they fought the bees and the bears to gather the honey, and they either had to protect it, because bees will come back and repossess their honey, or they basically carried it in animal skins, and it got rained on, and they drank the water off, probably safer in those days, and suddenly the honeypots went out in the rain. So, you know, today we make lots of honeypots.
A couple weeks ago, we had on a Danish mead maker, and I can't remember his name.
Oh, the guys from Vikings Blood?
Yes, Vikings Blood. So he said basically for him the issue is they actually have to expand their honey sourcing, and they're trying to get honey from Africa now. Where do you get your honey from?
Yeah, we only buy True Source certified honey, which means it's independently verifiable back to the beehives. So a bee in its lifetime makes a 1/12 of a teaspoon. It takes 6,500 bees to go to 1.2 million flowers to get enough nectar to make enough honey for us to make 2 bottles of mead.
And what's going on with, like, the collapse of the bee community?
Yeah, it's been pretty scary. This year alone, there was at least a third of the hives, commercial hives, collapsed. And, while New Hampshire had a bumper crop of honey last year, it's the winterization and the challenges of the bee mites and the pesticides that are being used that are wiping out the colony. So, you know, call your congressman, ask him what they're doing.
I have a friend, and she got a beehive and put it on her deck, and it died because of the same thing. There were mites, and she didn't know how to deal with it.
Do you have is your honey from New Hampshire, or are you allowed to use any honey from the States?
We buy honey through McClure's, which is actually can be anywhere from Canada, United States, or Argentina. But the key for us is we want to know where it actually came from.
Right, because you can have honey packaged anywhere, and they can label it as USA honey, but it doesn't necessarily mean it came from the States.
Yeah, I could care less where they package the honey.
Right.
I mean, I'd love to buy all the New Hampshire honey possibly to use, but the only challenge there is you can't, you know, we can't get enough honey from the state of New Hampshire.
But we're jumping over. Listen, sorry, Raphael. We're going back to esoteric. This is awesome. This is one of my favorite things I've ever drinking. The Memento Mori Dandelion Wine. Tell us how you made that. It's a little bitter, but it's nice. And you know they used to make beer with dandelions too, right, Chris?
Sure,
indeed. Botanicals.
Well, you know I love this because two things. It's probably the first wine that I tried to make when I was a teenager. Because my stepmom was sort of an herbalist, and if you're into herbs, you sooner or later get Susan Weed's book, which has a recipe for dandelion wine. Everyone all over America, you know, is usually using a recipe that's based on her thing, which is a horrible, horrible recipe for making wine, because it involves, like, taking a piece of bread and turning it upside down, and, like, there's no idea that you might rack it or, you know, do any of the normal... You know, it's an herbalist approach to making wine, so... when I started getting back into this, I wanted to you know, that wine's horrible. It's, like, really cloudy, and it just tastes like dead yeast. And I was like, but dandelion wine is this amazing product that was made by farmers for themselves in New England, and not so much to get drunk on, but to have a tonic. And what that meant was that in the early spring, they would drink the dandelion wine. Like, you drink this in, like, a little 2-ounce cup. You know, it's a little bit bitter, and you can taste the flower and stuff. But the reason they were drinking it was that they were all sick. Because if you were a farmer in New England in the 17th century or the 18th century, you had scurvy in spring because you hadn't had vitamin C for 4 or 5 months. So when you ate dandelions or you drank dandelion wine, which is more importantly a way to preserve the vitamins of the dandelions, you would suddenly get better. And that was a really important tonic, and it was really important for the farmers in New England. So when I wanted to reapproach that, it took a long time to get it right. And you can buy dandelion wine, and it's kind of the same thing. They wave a dandelion over it, and, like, they call it dandelion wine. And, you know, it's maybe, like, basically sugar water that's been fermented. There's, in this bottle, which is a small...
Wait, half-size, so how do you make your dandelion wine?
Well, I can't give away all my secrets, but I will tell you...
Michael some new ideas.
I will tell you that the main secret is that you need a lot of dandelion flowers. You can't skimp.
Dandelion flowers.
Yes, so these are the heads of the flowers. If you're a kind of weird internet nerd and you're looking this stuff up online, there's, like, sometimes people, like, take off all the green parts. But the green part's important. It's what gives it the vitamins and the flavor. So, you know, you have to go out there at 10 in the morning and pick. The flowers are open for one day. And actually, if you don't want to, like, completely lose your mind, you really can only pick them for 2 or 3 days out of the year, because that's when the bloom is, when they all come up. And there's pictures on my website of this, like, field of yellow. You have to go out on that day. You can pick as many as you can for 2 or 3 days, and then you freeze them. And the freezing is important because it breaks the cells open without boiling them, and then also it allows me to go around to the wildcrafters and get them all at the same time when I wasn't able to pick them all myself.
Do you have a pounds per gallon recipe, or how does that work?
I can't. Yeah. I do actually.
You don't want to share. I thought this whole thing about homebrewing and everything was about sharing.
I'll tell
Isn't
you every single recipe.
No, you know, I wish I just knew it off the top of my head.
He can't remember.
It's a lot.
He's been drinking all afternoon.
Let's just say this. I probably did 36. It's probably a pound a gallon, almost.
Okay.
Like, of heads. Maybe a little bit less.
That's pretty respectable.
Yeah, 70, you know, maybe 3/4 of a pound of gallons. I mean, the weird thing is I used to do it by size. And you learn pretty quickly, like, if there's homebrewers out there, just buy a digital scale, like, stop measuring things. But you have to, like, the dandelions, you'd put them in the bucket and you'd never fill up the bucket because they would just keep sort of compressing down. And so I didn't know the first time I did it how many I had.
But it's, so you get the dandelion heads, then what do you do? I mean, what do you make, like, some...
Well, you have to make a tea, and then essentially I'm using that tea to make a mead. And then there's a few other things in it.
Is there honey in it?
Right. Well, then there's honey, because you need, the flowers themselves don't really have any sugar. Not enough to make a wine. So you're basically making a mead that has, like, a really heavy infusion of flowers and orange peel. And the orange peel is important because it gives it a bit more of the bittering agent, and also the volatile chemicals in the orange peel that kind of lifts the flavor up a lot. I think that's really important.
Now, what's the ABV on this one?
This one's a little bit higher.
This is 35%.
No, I think we're at like 13 here.
Okay.
Is yeah, this is you know, this is great, is that we got Michael here who's really doing it with his meat, and we've got Raphael. We're looking back at these traditional, like really awesome recipes. So, Michael, I want you to make us a commercial dandelion wine. And what would you call it? That's what I want to know.
Ooh. Deflower.
Wow, that's good. That's nice.
That's why he gets the ladies.
Right? Thanks.
So, Chris, what else? So we're going to go to Burb Castle tonight. We're going to check out the New York City Homebrewers Guild, the Mead Night.
Yes, the New York City Homebrewers Guild 13th annual mead day. So if you want to learn how to make mead of all kinds, come hang out with us.
So you got the light mead or the, what do you call it, the quick mead? Or
Short mead.
Short mead.
And we'll also talk, you know.
Also known as Hydromel.
We'll talk a little bit about Braggots, which is kind of like a beer mead blend or kind of combo.
Which is interestingly not possible to make in the United States anymore.
Why not?
Because a proper Braggot would probably be like mostly a wine. You know, it would be a high 13-14% alcohol, right? So if you're making a honey wine, you're not really allowed to put grains in it because you're making it under a winery license, right?
The exception to the rule in a lot of wineries have done this is they form as a brewery. So like Rabbit's Foot out in California is listed as a brewery, and they make lots of really incredible Braggots.
Right. So I can make Braggots at 508.
Oh, wait, guys, I'm cutting out. Okay, we got to talk to this... A good friend of ours on Twitter. If you want to check us out at @beer_sessions, or you go to @heritage_radio. You can be a member. Don't forget, Heritage Radio Network, you become a member. It's @beardedladies. I'm putting together a culinary event and looking for beer brewed with local, sustainable ingredients inspired by your show suggestions. So, Chris, last year we did an event called Farm Plus Beer Expo. We had different breweries that had made beers with their own local ingredients. I know Kelso's done it. Wandering Star did it. Are you at 508 Gastro Brewery making any beers with local ingredients?
I've talked to John Conzella about the hop thing that he's doing out in Long Island. I've met a couple of different people. There's a guy upstate that just started making his own grain. I am using local ingredients from farmers markets. I have done a Braggot down there by getting some Andrew's honey and some other like Nature's Way honey. But as far as grains grown in New York State, I have not yet used any. I would like to, and I'm really excited about this new maltster.
So it's Conzella Farm also out in Long Island.
Yeah, I'm very excited to work with John, too. But I can't until hop harvest. You know,
yeah. So at Bearded Ladies, just so you know, yes, there are several brewers, including Brooklyn Brewery and Kelso. They do make batches with local ingredients.
Absolutely.
We'll tell you more about that and follow us on Twitter @beer_sessions and @heritage_.
Radio.
All right. And so now we're going to have to do our closeout. Tomorrow night, if you want to learn more about mead, if you're listening live, Michael and Bernice from Moonlight Meadery and Chris Kuzby will be at Jimmy's Number 43. We'll be celebrating New Hampshire's Moonlight Meadery. And we're going to be sampling at least probably 10 different meads. And do you have your tickets for Savor in New York City yet? This premier food and beer pairing event. It's coming up, savorcraftbeer.com. It's June 14th and 15th. We'll be leading a panel, which is kind of cool. And our good friends, Sam Merritt of Civilization of Beer, is offering a special, it's called Pre-Savor Boot Camp. It's going to be at Jimmy's Number 43, June 13th, civilizationofbeer.com. So actually, that's coming up in June. When Savor comes to New York, it's usually in D.C. It's the first time here in New York. It's a great beer minds. It's going to be probably one of the most interesting beer events ever in New York City. Don't you think so, Chris?
It's a fantastic event. It's an awesome event. I've been to it a couple times throughout the years. It's really grown. It's all about food pairing and beer, like every brewery. And you get to participate through a lottery. So it's a beers that you won't always see in New York City that have a one-day kind of thing. So
And a number of Good Brasil bars are going to be featuring small Long Island breweries that weekend as well. So
yeah.
Go to goodbrasil.com and you can learn more about what's going on. Also, a special event coming up, Eat the City, Farming the Five Boroughs. Check it out at tenement.org. That's going to be happening in New York. And check out our website for more events. Again, goodbrasil.com. I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com. Again, greatbrewers.com, awesome stuff. And without them, they represent Michael's Moonlight Meadery. They represent Wandering Star Brewery, a lot of really great breweries. And thanks to the Good Brasil. And if you like this podcast, give us a good review on iTunes, too. Hey, thanks to Raphael, Chris, Michael, and Bernice for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor, engineer Joe Galarraga, and our intern, Justin Kennedy, and our great new assistant programming guy over there, Eddie. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Yeah. All right.
Halloween.
Drink mead.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.